The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So as I rang the bell to end that short sitting, I thought that it's a pity to interrupt perfectly good silence in order to teach something. So it goes. I want to welcome you all to this Dharma practice day. And for those of you who are new, I would like to say a few words about what these days are like. They are meant to be a way of exploring practice, the Dharma, in a variety of different ways that hopefully are quite personal and quite engaging, and also involve your exploration in community with other people. When I first thought of these kinds of days, I was thinking about the experience I had in monasteries where we learn or engage in the practice in many different ways, but including a lot of conversation with the other residents in the monasteries. We'd often have Dharma discussions about different topics. Maybe the abbot would give a Dharma talk, and then later in the day we'd sit around after lunch or something and talk about, what did he say there? what do you think of that? And a lot of the learning, classically in Buddhism, in monasteries and monastic life, doesn't happen from the teachers down to the students, in a sense, but happens between the students because they know each other, they talk to each other, they share what they know, their experiences and all that. So the way these days are designed then is they're variable. Each day is a little bit different. Some days the general day, how it goes, would be that there'd be a little bit of meditation, maybe some guided meditation on the topic of the day, and then maybe a little teaching on the topic of the day that I will give, and then some kind of maybe exercise or some kind of question that I pose to you that then you'll discuss among yourselves. And sometimes we break into pairs to discuss it, sometimes in larger groups to discuss it. And so in various ways. And a little bit depends on the topic, the day unfolds. If you feel that some of the exercises or discussions are challenging for you, that's good. So that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be here. It means that you're challenged and you get to look at something and be with something. So the theme for the year is the seven factors of awakening. And we're now on the seventh factor of equanimity. And after this, we'll have one more meeting. And in about 2 weeks, I think it is, 3 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, we'll have the last meeting. And then we do kind of an exploration of how these seven factors of awakening work together. But for now, today it's equanimity. So for those of you who are new, the seven factors of awakening are seven qualities or factors of mind that come into play when the mind gets strongly unified or integrated into practice, into being mindful, concentrated. And if you consider that the normal mind in everyday life is somewhat scattered, or somewhat fractured, or somewhat never really has a chance to kind of settle into one mode, but really in a calm, stable way. The seven factors of awakening are those factors of mind that come into play when the mind is no longer scattered, no longer fragmented, no longer unsettled. But when we get unified, collected, calm, and settled in our practice, then these seven factors start coming into play. So, for example, if you're calm and relaxed, it's relatively easy to be attentive to what's happening around you. If you're agitated and stressed about something, you can't really be that attentive. You're distracted from what's going on. In fact, I think if you're well rested, relaxed, not preoccupied by anything, and just sitting under a nice oak tree, chances are you would probably be somewhat cognizant, aware of your surroundings and yourself and what's going on. Also, if you're somewhat settled in your attentiveness, then probably there would be some degree of interest in what's going on. So some degree of kind of like, what is this? Not just let the mind just wander around, but some heightened sense of engagement with what is happening to see more clearly what's happening. So even like if you're sitting under that wonderful oak tree, being relaxed and alert, at some point you might get interested in the stream, the river that's flowing by in front of you, and your kind of mind gets absorbed into that river, just looking at the ripples and the waves and the fish and whatever's going on. You get interested, then you're kind of focused. And then at some point, as practice gets stronger, the combination of the attentiveness, the mindfulness, and the interest translates into greater energy, greater willingness to engage more fully, put more effort in, or to hang in there, persevere longer in the practice of what you're doing. And then from there, if you engage more fully in one activity, there are times when then some joy or delight, satisfaction arises because of that. It's not an uncommon experience for many of you, I hope, that you have some endeavor in your daily life that you enjoy doing when you get involved doing it. And some people will do it in order to de-stress, to have something to do with it. They play music, perhaps, or they read a book, or go for a run, or something. There's a kind of a well-being that wells up when you're really fully engaged in one thing. So then, with that sense of well-being and joy, a lot of our stresses, anxieties, agitation of our life can begin falling away more and more. And then a sense of tranquility or calmness has an easier chance to arise. When the mind is contented, happy, focused, attentive, and calm, it's a lot easier to get concentrated. And so the mind could really kind of become much more unified, collected, one-pointed, really focus intently on something. With all those factors in place, coming into play, mindfulness, interest, I'm calling today, effort, joy, tranquility, and concentration, there comes into play what the tradition calls upekkha, which is equanimity. A balance of mind, an evenness of mind. The word equanimity in English comes from the word animate, the life force, kind of life spirit, what keeps us animated, and the prefix to even, to have an even animated spirit. So you're kind of balanced, you're not agitated by things. And so when you're really strong in practice, you have a sense of purpose, a sense of value, there's a feedback loop because it feels good and appropriate. You're really kind of, your mind's not going to go anywhere else, focused here. Then a lot of things can happen to you and you're not going to react to it. You're going to stay even and balanced with that. If you're really coursing beautifully in your practice and someone says they don't like your shoes, that's not going to affect you much. But if you're had a really hard day and stressed out and late for your appointments and feeling pretty insecure anyway, and someone comes along and says they don't like your shoes, it just pushes you over the edge. It's like one thing too much, And so you burn your shoes or something. So what I'm trying to point out, so the seven factors of awakening are ordinary factors of mind that come into play for people. They're not like strange mystical Asian qualities. They're there in your mind, in your heart, in your being, ready to operate. And hopefully you can consider that in certain areas of your life, they do come into play. Sometimes they come into play for unwholesome reasons, unskillful reasons. Some people have addictions that they're involved in. And so some of these same things get kind of triggered in the addictive process. And so they can get, very focused, a lot of energy in there, even some sense of serotonin release and kind of sense of well-being in that addictive process. But then it's unskillful, and it doesn't really come from a sense of equanimity because there's a kind of a greed. The mind is already leaning or collapsing or tightening up around something if there's an addiction. There's a neediness in it. When mindfulness is strong and these different factors have arisen in practice, the equanimity that happens is the whole, all seven factors of awakening arise without the greed, without these unskillful states of mind that can be there, without the aversion. And so when especially on retreat, these seven factors of awakening at times can be quite strong. So strong that sometimes they're the strongest experience, inner experience a person has. They stand out in the highlight. And it can be quite surprising sometimes where not only stand out in the highlight, but maybe it's the only thing left in their experience. So, you know, primary kind of predominance, like the whole field of experience, is primarily shaped by these seven factors of awakening. And then part of the play of practice, when that's the case, is for them to come into balance with each other. So they're all kind of evenly balanced and supportive of each other. And it's the function of equanimity, in part, to help with that balancing. Because if you're not equanimous about what's going on in your practice, not equanimous about these different factors, then it's very hard to have them balanced with each other. We lean too much into the joy, or we get tired of all this investigation, you know, or something. Equanimity appears at the end of the list, as it does in a number of other lists that Buddhism has. Partly because equanimity is kind of like the crown jewel of Buddhist practice, or maybe it's the something like that. It's very important. Some people associate equanimity with being indifferent, or being excessively cool, or aloof. That's not what's meant in Buddhism. Not meant to be indifferent. Not meant to be kind of detached. There can be a kind of very strong sense of engagement and presence, but at the same time, the mind doesn't get reactive. There's no ego involved that says this is for me or against me. We're not caught up in games of praise and blame in relationship to it, or pleasure and wanting pleasure or avoiding pain in relationship to it, or success and failure in relationship to it. All the ways the mind tends to react tend not to operate, even though the mind is very present and clear here for what's going on. It's a beautiful quality of mind, and when it stands out in relief, it's really one of the most beautiful things that a person can experience, short of liberation itself. A little bit of equanimity goes a long way, so we'll explore this topic today, and it doesn't have to stand out in relief, but perhaps by the end of the day, you'll be a little bit more reflective about the value of equanimity, more on the lookout for it, and perhaps more willing to evoke it, to call on that side of your mind when it seems appropriate. The last thing I'd like to say about equanimity is, as with many of these factors, seven factors of awakening, but particularly so with equanimity, they function as wonderful protections. And they can protect you, mostly from yourself, but protect you from the kind of the reactive mind, which you end up later say, why did I do that? Why did I act so quickly, impulsively? And so they have a strong sense of equanimity. There's a lot of teachings in Buddhism about equanimity. And so some of that I'll give today as we go through this day, as we explore it together. So with that, I thought we could do another sitting, a little guided sitting in equanimity. So if you'd like to stand and stretch and shake out and kind of get yourself ready so you can sit for another little period. So a couple of words of introduction to this meditation. I'm going to offer you some images that hopefully you could evoke in your own mind. Those of you who have decent capacity for visualization, then you could perhaps visualize these in some ways that bring them to mind. Those of you who don't tend to visualize very much, I'm not a visualizing person very much, I'm a word person. So then maybe there's very simple way in which you could bring up the thoughts, ideas, maybe a memory of some situation in your life that this image speaks to, and maybe just thinking about that memory can kind of help bring on this quality. So there are different images that the Buddha gave in support of or pointing towards the possibility of the mind being equanimous. So we'll see if these ancient images work today. So you could take an alert, comfortable posture. And one of the great supports for equanimity is not your mind, but your body. Taking some care with your posture to feel that your body and your posture is well grounded on your chair or on your cushion. It works really well when you're sitting cross-legged and you have this kind of wide base, like a base of a mountain. Your knees, butt. And feeling, you know, you might rock back and forth a little bit, so you can feel a little bit more of the extra, the contact against the chair or the cushion, the floor. Feel the support. And then feeling that, be aware of your torso, the way that the weight of your body is held in your body, supported by your lower torso, perhaps supported by your spine, so that it feels more like most of the weight of your body travels through your spine, one vertebrae on top of the other. Noticing if your body feels balanced. And if you've noticed that you're leaning a little bit to the left or the right, or a little bit too far forward or backwards, perhaps you can straighten up a little bit. An aligned, balanced posture makes it a lot easier to be equanimous. Buddha, first image I'll offer is the Buddha gave, is that of making yourself like a large, firm, solid mountain that is not moved by the wind that blows past the mountain. So can you visualize yourself or sense yourself with that kind of solidity, balance? A well-balanced, solid mountain. Perhaps by feeling some of the weight and substance of your body. And then within your body, as part of your body, become aware of your breathing. And see at first whether you can become aware of your breathing in a very allowing way, allowing yourself to breathe whatever way you're breathing, but take the time to become familiar with your breathing. As if there's nothing wrong with the way you breathe. Your job is simply to feel and sense, discover from the inside what the experience of breathing is like now. And having become familiar a little bit with your breathing, now there's some very, very simple way that you can adjust your breathing so your breathing feels a little bit easier, a little bit more relaxed. Perhaps softening the belly. Perhaps shifting a little bit where breathing occurs, where the movement happens in the chest or the diaphragm or the belly. Perhaps by ever so slightly extending the exhale, relaxing at the end of the exhale. Or relaxing at the end of the inhale. So the inhale maybe is a little bit more full. It can be easier to be equanimous when the breathing is relaxed. Or when we stay close to the breathing. The idea of equanimity is that it is a mind which doesn't get caught up in things or reactive to what's going on. The mind stays balanced, open. Awareness stays maybe relaxed. The mind or the awareness can be quite broad, not limited or bounded by concerns or judgments, fears. The boundaries of awareness are no boundaries. There's no outer edges of consciousness, of awareness. When we react, we create boundaries. So an image the Buddha used for the broad accepting nature of awareness of the mind is to imagine the mind to be like the great earth, broad, large, so large and big that if pleasant or unpleasant, agreeable or unagreeable things are thrown on top of the earth, and the earth doesn't react. If one spits on the earth stays balanced and broad and open. Can you imagine your mind to be like the earth? The Buddha said, when the mind is like the earth, agreeable and disagreeable experiences don't invade the mind and stick there. And then letting go of the image of the earth. Imagine, bring up the image of, or the idea of a vast body of water. Perhaps like the great ocean. You stand at the edge of the Pacific looking out, or in the middle of the ocean. The mind like a vast body of water. Soft, fluid, and if agreeable and disagreeable things fall on top of this great body of water, the water doesn't mind. It receives, it allows, it yields. In the same way, when the mind is like water, great expansive body of water. When agreeable or disagreeable things occur, they don't invade the mind or stick there. And then another image the Buddha gave was to make the mind like fire. Perhaps you can visualize or think of a large, powerful, strong fire. And in that strength and power of the mind, it's equanimous. Stays balanced, it's not affected by the things that are thrown into the fire. And while a fire maybe seems agitating, image, perhaps this is an image of real strength, vibrant strength, power. So when agreeable and disagreeable things occur, they don't invade the mind, stick there. And then the final image is the image of space, open, boundless space, expansive. You throw something into space, into the space is not disturbed or upset or reactive. Space accommodates whatever passes through it. There's an image of the idea of the way a musical note travels through space. So make the mind like space, open, expansive, porous. Sounds, thoughts, feelings, sensations arise in the boundless sea of space. And with a mind like space, nothing can invade the mind and stick there. So then to end this sitting, you can take some deep breaths and consider a little bit about how you might remain like earth or water or fire or space once you open your eyes. So for some people, images works really well to support the mind into some kind of state or some possibility or some quality. And these images that I offered you here, most of them came from the way the instructions that the Buddha supposedly gave his own son when he introduced his own son to meditation. He was going to give him meditation instruction, and before he gave it, or as preparation, or as part of the initial instruction on meditation, was he told his son to make your mind or your meditation like earth, like water, like fire, like air, and then like space. And after that, then he taught him to loving kindness practice. And after that, at some point, he taught him mindfulness of breathing. It's kind of interesting, the sequence in which, you know, where they build on each other, perhaps. So I'd be curious to hear from maybe a couple of you what it was like to kind of use those images, those visualizations, or those ideas of as part of the meditation. It's fine to say that it didn't work at all. So we have something to say.
At the time of the Buddha, the ocean was not polluted. And the earth was not as hectic as it is now. So it didn't really work for me.
Yeah.
And so I have my own visualization, sort of the earth. I picture the moon. In Germany, we have a saying, If a dog barks at the moon is not disturbed. And so that worked for me. And,
oh, nice.
And instead of a... I have a pond at the edge of a forest that is very tranquil. Mm-hmm. So I kind of... And fire is also too scary and hectic. So sorry, but I...
No, no, it makes sense. I mean, I was concerned about that when I was offering those images, and I thought about the oil spill and the Gulf and, you know, the scale. I mean, the scale of what the Buddha talks about here, he talks about spit and dung and blood. You know, when those things get put, you know, the water doesn't care, those things. It's much smaller scale. So it's easy for the mind to kind of think of exceptions or things like that. So, I mean, one way is just ignore it if it doesn't work. The other way is to give the image the benefit of the doubt, that it's you know, it's supposed to be a, it's supposed to be an image that helps you. So how can you, how, in what way can you imagine the earth as an image? You know, what do you bring with you into that image, and what do you leave out so it helps you in your practice? It doesn't have to be a complete, you know, complete picture of reality as it is right now. I've used images of the galaxy. You know, that's something that, you know, if the Earth is, you know, too complicated, you know, in the galactic time, the whole galaxy, you know, does it really matter? There's a lot more equanimity sometimes if you... The galaxy doesn't care too much if someone calls you a name.
Speaking to yours and actually what you just said too, I'm a geologist, so I work with really, really long time scales. And that's always been really helpful to me. And with these, with the Earth especially, with the image of the Earth, when I'm dealing with some reaction in myself, I always go back to thinking, oh, you know, 10,000 years, 20,000 years, this is nothing. This is nothing. And it's very helpful to me. Even when thinking about the pollution and all the things that are happening on the planet right now, truly the planet doesn't care. We are the ones that care. It doesn't really harm the planet. The planet will be fine. So we're the ones that are in danger.
So a little bit more about what it was like in your meditation. Yes.
Would equanimity mean being able to accept the oil in the ocean?
It means that you'd be able to accept it into your awareness without awareness contracting. Into your heart without the heart contracting. But you still might go out, you still would go out and try to save the birds. You still would go out and try to pass different laws. You still go out and do something. Your actions and the quality of your mind are two different things. And so equanimity, your mind wouldn't contract, it wouldn't get caught up in hate, wouldn't get caught up in greed. You know, the reactive mind wouldn't come into play. But the mind's still active when it's not reactive. And so we can be active much more effectively if reactivity is not clouding the waters. So this is not a substitute to just, oh, it's all fine, it's all okay. Remember, I was traveling with a girlfriend many years, hitchhiking around Oregon. That was in my hippie days. And, you know, it's all okay, man. And she left her flashlight someplace. And so, you know, she was concerned about her flashlight. And I said, it's all okay, man. And she got really angry with me. Appropriately so, I think.
Gil? I worked really well for me, especially the space one. But it was interesting because when you said the Earth, my first vision was the pictures we have of Earth from space down here. And then I realized that that's not how they saw the Earth. The Earth is something that's so big they can't see the end
edges of it.
And so when I switched my perspective, that became much more effective.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
It's a very specific mountain that first comes to mind. And same with water. It's very specific that I know so familiar, some experience with water. But then I did notice, like with Ursula, then I had a second thought when mentioning the ocean. It was so interesting watching the process of going into the oil spill, and then I basically went back to what she said. It was like, in the grand scheme, I could just visualize the ocean just saying, it's okay. So then I came back to my original comfortable. But it's very, those type of things, how intimate it is, experiences that relate, that I can just go, yes, this is, it's very helpful.
We were at Yosemite some years ago, a couple of years ago, with my sons. And I guess my son was 5 or something. And we were sitting at, is it called Angel Lake? What is it called? No. Vernal Lake. Mirror Lake, above Vernal Falls?
Yeah.
What's it called?
Emerald Pool.
Anyway, one of those lakes up there, beautiful. It was really beautiful. So very few people there. They're pristine. And I said, look at the lake. I said, and now close your eyes and see if you can visualize the lake. And I had him do it a couple of times. I said, okay, this is a good memory for you to have in your life. See if you can keep that with you. I suspect he doesn't have a clue anymore. But.
I was very intrigued by the idea of sitting with a fire, because that doesn't seem equanimous at all. And then I just thought of the fire as not being out of control, just being sort of a fire in control. And it... And then I thought about things falling into the fire and just sort of burning up. And I don't know, it was just very intriguing.
And the fire doesn't mind. Yes, it is intriguing. It's a little hard to sometimes see fire as being, work for equanimity because of it's so active, dynamic. But for me, it speaks to the idea of strength and power. That if you feel a lot of confidence and strength and power, it's a lot easier to feel balanced and equanimous about things. If you feel insecure, then in the insecurity, you know, it's easy to be pushed over and be preoccupied by whatever's going on. And part of the function of practice is to also make us feel strong. There's a kind of power that gets evoked or developed through Buddhist practice. And sometimes Buddhism has an association of being, these very calm, soft, non-violent, relaxed, accepting, meek kind of people. Pushovers. They go along with whatever. But I think that, some of it's true, that there's a lot of calm and relax and acceptance, but there also can be some real power and strength and determination, and that can be quite strong and dynamic. And I hope that we all tap into that at times in practice, and that also gives birth to equanimity, because in that strength, we're not going to be so reactive. So one more here for Ed.
Yeah, I started off with the fire, and then it kind of went down to coals, which is nice, that those are more even and glowing, it's harder to put them out. But then what came to me was the sun and some images from the Soho Observatory. And some of the stuff that goes on the surface of the sun, it's amazing, you see these images, and yet the sun is just so strong and just continues to, put out the energy. It's actually was a very good image, the sun.
Great. And So, you know, the way to use it, if you're interested in these kinds of images occasionally in meditation, you know, the way to use it, there's two ways of using it. One way is just is to use those images that help you with what you want to do. So if you want to be equanimous, use the images in a way, use the earth image in a way, see it, you know, in a way that helps you. The other way is to use an image like that and then see what else it stirs up. And then, you know, rather than become equanimous, do some investigation into what's been stirred up, and that can be very valuable to go into that as well. So now we've begun our discussion, exploration of equanimity. And what I'd like to do is it okay not to take a break for another 20 minutes? Maybe some of you can rush to the bathroom and back if you need to, but what I'd like to do is have you a chance to hear yourself talk about your own relationship to equanimity, how you feel about it, your thoughts about it, your you know, what comes to mind for you personally about equanimity. You know, are you thinking this is the best thing ever? Do you think, you know, I don't know about this equanimity stuff. If I, you know, I'm not sure. This is not a, you know, I'd rather, you know, be guarded or whatever. You know, anything. Now, what is your relationship to equanimity? And then see in the course of the conversation if you could describe in just, you know, hopefully not more than a minute, describe some particularly strong or significant experience of equanimity that you've had in your life. So over your lifetime, can you think back? And was there one incident that you can think of where it was really significant that you were equanimous? And what was it like, that equanimity? So what I had in mind was that you would pair up. So you each have a chance. One person talks, the other person is the witness, just listens. And then I'll ring a bell, and then you can switch roles. So when you start your turn to talk, you talk about your relationship to equanimity, and during the course of that, see if you can come up with one example from your life where equanimity was a particularly strong and useful quality you had at that particular moment. And I thought that there could be about, each person can talk for about 5 or 6 minutes. And then I'll, when you, both people have a chance to speak, I'll give you another 3 or 4 minutes to have a little bit more back and forth about it, just to follow up and finish up the conversation you had with someone. Seem all right? Is that clear? So you're welcome to spread out and bring some chairs or take chairs from the cabinets in the outer hall just to spread out some if you'd like. And you can, I'll ring a bell when you start in about a minute, and whispering. And then everyone would get quiet.
We're not as smart as a 5-year-old.
So maybe there could be, you know, I wasn't part of any of those discussions, so maybe one or two of you, just a little bit, say what that was like, anything significant that occurred for you, and being able to reflect on your relationship to equanimity. Here, Mary. Thank you.
Well, the green light is on, but I don't hear anything.
No, thank you.
Try it now.
That's it. Thank you. I guess the one thing that stood out for me and everything was how avoiding something can appear to be equanimity, but it's not.
Well, for me, it was talking about and discovering that I can be very passionate about a lot of things and still be equanimous about it at the same time. It's finding that line of kind of holding both states, you know, passion without addiction or extremism or taken to the point of stress. So it's just finding that balance between the two states.
Great, thank you. Behind you.
Well, first I have to say, that was actually really good, and I
am at my core an introvert, and so I hate the idea of talking to somebody, but it was good. So two things came out. One might be helpful. Well, I wouldn't even have thought of this, but both of us have the ability to be very calm in crises. So I wonder if there's some way we can tap into that, because in day-to-day life, maybe we're not capable, or at least I'm not so capable. And the other thing is, I realized that for me, I can't remember the phrase you were using when we were doing the visualizations, but basically it was like having equanimity when things happen that you don't like, but also that you like. And I realized I'm having reactions about the idea of having equanimity about the things that I like. And that actually happened this morning. Nothing really went wrong, but it wasn't what I like, which had been there for a few days. And so I had a reaction. So that's one.
I'm also an introvert, and I get nervous talking over one of these things. But in a crisis, solid as a rock. And I've talked with you about being offshore also. Just very calm, not indifferent at all. You know, there's still a level of happiness there that doesn't run away, a level of enjoyment that's not restless, you know, whereas right now restlessness is really, really huge. Why does it go away when it's such a comfortable state?
Great, thank you. So, great. So, let's take a break.
Can you answer
them? Oh. I didn't understand that he was expecting me to answer. So let's take a break and be equanimous about that, or not. And let's start again in here in 15 minutes, so at 11:20. Thank you.